Kirsty Neat interviewing Captain Harry Kinley at 2 Crottergaily on the 15th of February 1996. Right, first of all, I just want to start off with a few personal details. Where were you born and when
were you born?
In
Colby.
In Colby.
In a little house, right, almost opposite the front of the Malawi Church there. That's the Malawi Church.
Right.
And according to the deeds in that old house, when we were in it even, and that's a long time ago, I was born there and lived there until I was 3 years old, it was built for £10.
Right. So when were you born? What was the year?
1908. January the 7th, 1908.
1908. Right. And then you moved to Fistard, was it?
Fistard village, and over the top of the Varney Root Hill.
Right.
Beautiful big house up there.
Right. And what did your parents do? What did your father do?
My father was a master mariner too.
He is a master.
He went to sea.
And what boats did he work on?
Well, he was in Thomas Wilson's most of all his life. Thomas Wilson's at Whiting.
Right.
You see, Whiting was a very busy place those days. Rockelbank ships, big liners, but they actually commenced their nautical life in Whitehaven.
Right.
Rockelbank's all those big shipping companies in Liverpool. It was a very busy place. But,
so was he away from home a lot?
Oh, quite a lot.
Did he sail all around the world?
No, he sailed mostly coastwise.
Coastal,
yes,
British Isle coast.
British Isle, British Isle, occasionally to the continent.
Right, okay. So, where did you go to school?
I went to school, and first of all, we went to the school in Port St. Mary, called the Boys' School, you see. I'm afraid our education was pretty basic. But nevertheless, saying that, there were several friends of mine. One was Captain Mandrell, at the moment lives in Colby Village. There was, out of a class of 11, there was four of us master mariners. Master mariners.
Why do you think that was?
In those days, it was the three R's, you see. You had to learn writing, reading, and so forth. But then, however, when we come up about, I think it was 11, we had to sit for an examination for the Southern Higher Education School. That was up at the Four Roads, Port St. Mary, fine old school it was too. And you had to pass quite a stiff examination for it, and quite a lot of us did pass, you see. But I stayed there until I was 14. And when I was 14, I could have stayed till 16, I regretted this all my life. I sat outside Ellerslie, the house up in Fistard Village, sitting on the steps there. Mother came out and I wouldn't go to school. I was 14, I didn't go to school. The only chance is my clip in the year. It's a pity because I should have been made to go.
Right, so you decided that you just didn't
want
to go anymore.
So anyhow, as I say, there's five of us. It was the ambition, my ambition in life was to get master of an Isle of Man's passenger boat.
Right.
I wasn't interested in anything else, foreign sailing at all. Which I did do. My last vessel was the Ben McCree, a fine vessel she is too.
Right.
And,
when did you actually first start working on the boats then?
The Isle of Man boats?
Any boats? When was your first?
Well, I went when I was 16. I went out to Liverpool and I joined a vessel out there called the Briarfield, one of the Savages of Liverpool. And I was there for two as an ordinary seaman and an MVE, and then I joined my father's old company in Whitehaven. Wilson Steamship Company was by now, was Thomas Wilson, first of all. But however, I stayed with that company as second mate, and eventually master.
What does second mate mean? What does that
say? Well, second mate is like he looks after the end, he looks after the crew, runs the crew,
right.
And he's responsible for keeping the vessel clean, especially
right.
passenger boats.
Right.
And he's also the navigating officer, especially in passenger boats.
Right. So you're sort of responsible for cooking, would that be?
No, just cleaning.
Looking after the crew
generally? Making that the sailors do their work on deck to keep the ship properly clean.
Right, so sort of...
Cleaning brass.
Managing the crew.
He's like the ship's manager.
Right.
Put it that way.
Right.
Although the master was responsible for whatever happens.
Right.
If the cook had truth, he's still responsible for it.
Right. So you had to keep an overview and make sure everyone's working.
Yes, oh yes, yes.
Right, okay.
Like, and then another thing was... Your job in those days, you'd have three or four gangways out, and you were responsible for those. So you are the carpenter. Make sure the gangways are secure and the passengers get aboard all right and ashore all right, you see. and at the proper time the gangways were taken in prior to sailing. That's your job, and then the navigation of the vessel.
Right, okay.
That's
basically what the second mate does. So when you were working for the Briarfield, was it Briarfield you said?
Yes, the Savages of Liverpool. Right.
Well, was that a cargo?
Cargo. Mostly coal and timber and things like that from Liverpool to Dublin, down to Cork and round the west coast,
right,
and down the Bristol Channel, occasionally to through the French ports.
Right. So how long did you stay with them?
I was a Savages only about 2 years. And then I went to Thomas Wilson's, which is the Wilson Steamship Company, actually. Right. And I stayed with them until I was master. I was second mate, master in that company. I got my first ship at 22 years. I was 22 year old.
So that means you're in charge of the whole ship?
The whole ship.
Goodness me. So it didn't take you very long
to work your way up. Pretty handy. Yes. Yeah. I was very keen. That was my life. That's the life I wanted. Therefore, I'd take a good job. It was a hard life, believe you me, coasting those days, especially when the depression was off. There's so many people there ready to jump into your job if anything happened.
Right.
See?
Right.
And ship owners, you had to be at sea practically every night. To go weatherbound was criminal. That's what so many coasters lost in those days, right, in the 1930s.
So regardless of the weather conditions, you had to go.
We just had to, especially a light ship, you see.
Right.
But it's a good life. It was different than today. It's only press button today, you see. For example, it had to be proper navigation. And the Irish Sea is one of the worst places, I would say, in the world to navigate a ship. You've got so many strong tides and bad weather. I know during the war, these ships in the Atlantic, I used to think it was a pilot from the bar, they hated the Irish Sea. Coming across the ocean, being torpedoed or bombed from the air, that was bad. But to enter the Irish Sea, they really hated it.
Right. Probably one of the worst places in the world.
Absolutely.
The combination.
Yes.
So the second company that you worked at, was that a passenger boat?
Then after that company, I went to Savages. Thomas Wilson,
Thomas
the second company. And then the steam packet.
So what year did you start with?
I joined the steam packet in 1936.
As a second mate.
Well, we'd done half a season as a seaman. We had to do that to get in the company.
Right, so what's that? Is that just a general sailor?
Yeah, that's right. But when you came second mate, then you became more responsible. You were responsible.
Right. So you first joined the steam packet.
Right.
You first joined the steam packet as a general seaman. What sort of tasks would that involve?
Well, that's like an ordinary sailor, cleaning decks and taking watches, how to take your watch, and so forth, you see.
Right.
And splicing ropes. A probably seaman's job.
Seaman.
Which I'd only had that trained for that. About 3 or 4 months. And then I got appointed second officer.
Okay. And what vessels were sailing? Sailing on at that time?
Well, I joined the Mona's Isle as second mate. The Mona's Isle, the Russian Castle, the Peel Castle. Russian Castle, Peel Castle, the Mona's Queen, Ben McCree, the Lady of Man, which is the finest ship in the fleet. And then after the war, there was the King Harry, which was lost at Dunkirk. The Mona's Queen was lost at Dunkirk. And the King Harry was lost at Dunkirk. They're all fine, able ships. Then after the war, then they called to replace them with similar ships of a similar name.
Yeah,
you see?
1, 2, 3.
Yes. Exactly. And then after the war, do you want me to continue in that line?
Yeah, that's right.
Then after the war finished, I'm coming from ahead of your time, really, I beg your pardon.
Sorry.
After, you wouldn't remember this, when the war broke out, you see, all our oil-burning ships were sent forthwith to Southampton. And we had the best passenger boats of troop ships we ever had. We were at sea practically every night, except a Sunday night. Sadly, it was Sunday night. But all the other ships, London, North West, and British Rail, and all, they were about 2 or 3 trips a week at the most. But our ships were speedy, and they were carrying passengers, which were troops, you see. They were absolutely ideal. And consequently, we were backwards and forwards every night. We load up the passengers in the afternoon, so that our troops were go down to the room defence, that's down at the fort, at the end for Southampton Water. And we have a rendezvous there, and each ship in its turn, you see, will go out. There's forts in Southampton Water, three forts, huge forts, are still there. And you had to look out, which is second mate's job, for one flash of a light. Only got one flash. That was to tell the Commodore be watching that we had to proceed to sea. The Commodore go first, we turns about as Commodore, and then the other ships just follow up in line. In the dark, you know, complete blackout. And the entrance was about a quarter of a mile, a little long, wider than that. That's the entrance. And each side was buoyed with a single light shining on the water. Only person, you hardly see it. And for your entrance, mined after that each side. So you had to go through that gap.
It was really close.
In line, like that. Then you went down a swept channel, then three abreast. You see. Swept channel be about, guessing, of course, now I'd say 10 to 12 miles. A narrow channel, buoyed every so far, When you get to the end of that channel then, you set your courses for wherever you're going. Cherbourg was port 23, the opens by numbers. Kelly or Cherbourg or Le Havre. And you set course for that. And each ship then, the Commodore would pick out a zigzag course. You see, you gotta go like that. And they're different numbers. You see? We're very often, number 8 was the popular one. You go along, steering the course, you're on. You save for argument's sake, say where you're going, southeast. Well, then you'd alter, the clock then, only clocks. And right round the dial was little discs, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, back to 5 minutes, back to go round. And the minute finger, when we touch this, we ring a bell. So the ships, when they hear the bell, you've got 5 to port. It ring then 10 minutes, 5 to port again. And then another one, come back for 5 to starboard. Then 5 to starboard. And then back on the original course. Then 5 to starboard. That's the way, and there's a wonderful sight in the moonlight. Pardon me, moonlight. You see those ships doing about 18 to 20 knots. Each one, dragging each
other. So they're all doing it together.
You had to. And if they missed up, well, there's trouble. Yeah. We never did. I don't ever remember our ships colliding. It was a magnificent sight. The old steam packet ships were the best of the lot. As I say, they were very efficient.
They're very fast and they could carry a lot.
They carry a lot of troops.
Bodies, yeah, right.
So we'll eventually get to Cherbourg where we're going. And land your passengers and then home independently. Not destroyers or anybody. Always the destroyers on each side, of course. You give him the number off your zigzag and he'd be doing the same thing.
Right. When you first started working as a second mate, before the war, again, how many people would crew the ship, say? If it was a passenger ship.
We take my last ship, for instance, Ben McCleese, he'd have crewed the five-week ship. All together, including stewards, carpenters, engineers, and it was 65.
That's 65.
And it averaged around about the 58-60, right through the fleet. You see, you've got the man boats, lifeboats, you've got the lifeboats, you see, for leaving for accidents and things like that. And each man had a lifeboat man have his own position in the lifeboats, you see. If you want to, like an accident, you want to abandon ship, each man had his own particular lifeboat. It took a lot of people. Then there's fire watching, if a fire breaks out, each man had a different hose pipe and so forth. You see, and they all had to be numbered and placed. You see?
So were there more staff on the passenger ships than on the cargo?
Oh yes, much more
cargo,
The average cargo would be about 10 to 12, but that's 8, 10 or 12, according to the size of the passenger boat, or the cargo boat rather.
Right. So how many passengers did your first ship hold?
The average from, according to the gross tonnage, that was a good idea, the average from 2,000 up to 3,000 in average. For instance, my ship was about just under 3,000.
What was the name of it again?
The Ben McCree. And the old Ben McCree likewise. And the Lady of Man too. The fine carrying vessel.
Yeah.
You
know, huge
capacity. All marvellous boat. Yeah.
So in the early days, in the 30s, how many sailings would you do with passengers? How many sailings would you do?
Well, I'll give you one instance there. You'd come in, you're up from one weekend of 1937, before the war broke out. We were sailing constantly. We left in the Manx Maid of Vietnam. And we started on a Friday morning, out from Douglas. Midnight back to Lincoln, William Hannibal. Out again midnight to Liverpool. And back again that next morning to Liverpool. That's the week I'm telling you we shipped 99,000 passengers. Mind us, as I say, there was at that time running the B, at least 11 passenger boats caught up in that one.
Right,
you see.
Right. Yeah. And would they all sail between Douglas and...
Douglas and Liverpool, that's the most particular journey.
That was the main route.
Then there's Heysham, and Fleetwood, that was the other big station too. And Aderarson, Belfast, Dublin, those are the main stations. Well, the most busy was Liverpool, Heysham, and Fleetwood.
Did you have much to do with the passengers?
Oh yes, well you also had a little chat with them on the deck where there was some of us were famous to be up on the bridge for an hour or something like that.
You take them up?
Yes, I always had people on the bridge, but when they approached the bar, you had to go off.
Yeah.
Or approached the Douglas within 3 miles of, you had to leave the bridge. But it was entertainment for them, and they appreciated it. Yeah. See?
I was looking at some photographs in the this book, which is the latest one on the history, The Life and Times of the Steam Packet.
Oh yes, I got that.
I'm sure you got that one. Yeah. Yeah. I was looking at some photographs.
It's a fine book, that.
It's lovely pictures in it of the cabins, the insides of the ships, and the different classes.
Yes.
Can you maybe describe the different types of areas where passengers could stay, and what sort of classes there were, and how they all differed?
Going back to the old lady man.
Yeah.
She, as I say, she was the thing of finest vessel she ever had, well lighted at her. Now she had magnificent accommodation, absolutely magnificent. Both cabins and dining rooms, and sleeping quarters, private cabins and whatnot. They're well laid out, you see. Now this King Harry, today's King Harry, she's very posh too with all these cabins and wireless and what, but then she's up to date. The ships I'm talking about, I'm going back 20 years, so 23, 23 years. And they went so up to date, but nevertheless, they're very comfortable. The private cabins and the shelter deck, the shelter deck and the upper deck and the top deck, they're all well catered for.
Right.
And the dining saloons in particular, they're really good. And the buffets. And those days, you had deck chairs. There's no cars, you see. We had about 500 deck chairs. It's a good thing for the seamen. They don't like weather. That's not the seamen. They save so much. They save their money up all the summer and happen to call a real milieu. A milieu now is a Manx for a party, sort of. Uh-huh. In Barrow, mostly in Barrow. They'd have a rare time, see, with the money they made on the chairs during the summer.
Oh, I see. So they would sell tickets, would they, for the chairs?
No, just no tickets.
Just take money for the chairs.
It was the perks for the seamen.
Right. So that was like a sort of sideline that they could deal with.
Yes. Oh, they're very popular too. Of course, we couldn't do it laterally because we had to take cars and money. You see, before we got these side loaders, Ben McCree and that sort of, we had to have all the cars on deck.
Actually, outside on the deck.
The passenger deck, the shelter deck, very busy to take those cars, and you have to be very careful what you've done. The chief officer was his responsibility, and the second officer. You had to have their minis. A ship narrows towards the bows, and she comes up broad, and she narrows towards the stern again. Now you had to take advantage of all that room. And you took the mini cars first. With me, because you're squeezing the engines. Yes. See? And then them on a little bigger, and some of the boats, we used to have a post office aboard one of the ships there, and that was a berth to the post office berth, where she begin to wide red, the wider bit. Then the purser's room, and on right to the square. You see, that's where they have to dangle comes in. Now there's quite ample room there for buses, coach occasionally, whatever. And then the intermediate cars further right after. It was a tricky job.
So it's a bit of an art, actually, getting the vehicles on and getting them all in the right place.
You see, and what do we used to annoy a lot of the passengers to, especially at midnight from Liverpool, they'd be up in the waiting room, you see, come there from about 6 o'clock in the evening, getting from all around the country, especially in Yorkshire, and around Bradford, Leeds and all that area. And they'd be up there, and about 9 o'clock we'd open the ship up to take cars aboard. Well, they'd their passengers as well. You couldn't let them. You had to take the car, you had to take the passenger too. Or they'd wander around the landing stage. You'd probably get into trouble or fall in the river. So we had to take them aboard with the cars. So you imagine the people up there sitting at 6 o'clock. You see, after come all the way from Bradford or someplace like that. They were wonderful people. And seeing these people going down with cars and going right on board. But we had to put up with that.
Yeah, yeah.
We used to get some abuse too.
I bet you did. So they had to wait.
It's hard to explain, but there's no use.
Yeah, they
get the best seats and cabins too while they were on board, you see. Well, a lot of the cabins were already back booked by people who booked them.
Yeah.
I didn't interfere with that. But it was quite a difficult job.
Keeping everybody
I've been
up.
Called some awful names in my day. I'm paying too much. See, but you
pretty
had
strong.
To do it. And we've got experts driving cars. You see, the man, you drive his own car. And we had to direct them what to do, right hand or left hand. Some of them start off all right, then they get a bit sick of you doing it. They tried to do it themselves, and of course, they couldn't. Everything was so narrow and complicated.
Yeah.
It's only the officer who was guiding them could see what was happening. And we always learnt that by if the rear wheel is going astern, or going back, if the hub of the rear wheel will miss anything, the whole car will. We learned that. But it was a tricky job.
Sounds like it.
And I was the chief officer's job was to the car landed in the crane on board, most of them.
Oh right.
Oh yes,
crane
on board.
Craned
and then the second officer would take over. I said, right, put him so and so and so and so. You see. And then if it was an awkward job, the chief had to go himself with him and help. In the meantime, he'd come down another car there waiting for him. It's quite a difficult job.
Would they crane the coaches on as well?
What?
The coaches that went.
Oh yes, yes.
Crane on
except a certain rates of tide, certain times of tide. If you could get the skids out and the grids out, you see, that's like two little lanes.
Yeah.
Then they put them lanes on board. There again was a tricky job too. But that's only when the ship was high up.
Right.
You see, at the landing stage, of course, you was all this up at one level. It was quite handy there. You see, the landing stage.
Uh-huh.
But Fleetwood was a bit awkward. He's in all those places.
But
we got through it, and we managed. But it's a tricky job, believe you me.
Sounds like it.
Yes.
So, when the cabins, do you know how much they would have cost, say, a first-class cabin for a night crossing?
In the 1930s?
Yeah.
Well, I'd have to make a rough guess. I'd say it cost then about, perhaps, £2.
Right.
Well, I may be wrong.
You might be wrong. And you'd get, what facilities would you have inside the cabin?
Well, you'd have a press button there for a steward when you want tea, anything like that. They're very comfortable, too.
Right. And would there be bunk beds, or...?
Not just beds, but each side of the room.
Right. So I think
there was one or two of them had bunk boards as well.
Right. So quite large tier. Then, really.
Well, yeah, fine cabin. They're very comfortable.
Yeah.
Warm.
Yeah.
Because we didn't have television, anything like that, like we've got today.
Yeah. So were there any entertainments on the ships? Do they have entertainment?
Not really. We'd have wireless spelling out your soul or someone talking on the air, but that's about as far as you've got.
No dancing.
Yes. You're doing plenty of dancing when you're doing this.
Absolutely. And what sort of food did they serve in the dining rooms in the first class?
Well, the food was quite good. The food was really good in those days. Plenty of it too.
So lots of variety. Do they have like a full menu? Or?
Yeah. Oh yes, one menu.
Right. And did the crew eat? And do they have a separate?
They separated their own quarters down aft. You see, their own quarters down there, which was quite good too. They never went short of anything at all. Of course, a lot of the crew bought their own food. You see, in my time, a lot of the crew they had to go ashore and buy their own food. And there's a galley down aft, they helped themselves, cooked
right.
it themselves.
So they made their own.
But eventually, of course, that was cut out, and they had their own, the food, the ship's crew, It happens, you see, at their own place, the Hatford, too.
Right. So, did you serve on cargo ships as well?
Yes, I was in the cargo ships. The first master ship, the master, I was first, my first passenger boat was the King Harry.
That's your first passenger?
Yes, passenger boat.
Right.
And that week, I was appointed master, and the weather was just touching. And that week, I had three coaches to bring over. Double-decker, the coaches, buses are just coming in, as you see them today. And they get one at a time on the forecastle head, you see. And your strongest part of the ship, then, was spray coming over, was the windows on the bus. Oh, you see, that was a tricky job, too. And I had three for that first week. And we managed two of them. But the third one, the crane was bringing them out of the dock, wouldn't come out, the weather was too bad. We were quite willing to take it, but he wouldn't come to service. I had two of them 1 week. That was my first job in the passenger boat.
Goodness me. And what sort of cargoes did you take?
Deck cargo? Well, mostly edibles, fruit, and things like that. But mainly fruit and all sorts of edible food.
That was bringing into the island.
Dublin, yeah. And we'd bring empty bottles and stuff out, which you see.
Right, okay. I want to know who names the ships. I mean, after the war they brought in new types and they just called them King Henry 4 or 5, etc. But who actually decides what the ships are going to be called?
The directors.
The directors,
too. The management directors. And the marine superintendent, he has, I think, a voice in it too.
Right.
But I think it was like someone who was crying in the wilderness.
So the routes were pretty set between here and Heysham and Liverpool and Ireland sometimes Scotland.
Yes.
When did the passenger seasons really sort of take off?
It took off at Easter.
At Easter?
Easter. Easter took off. But, and when we went to Belfast and Douglas, those days, they called it Ramsey Pier. That was a tricky job sometimes, too, because there was a bit of the big side for it, you see. It's just the end of the pier, and you had to come alongside like that.
Yeah. So pick up more passengers in Ramsey?
Well, yes, more chests at Ramsey. And land them on the way back, day excursion to.
So you do
day
excursions to Belfast?
Belfast.
Right.
Up to Rossi occasionally. Up to Rossi, too, with his passengers.
And how long would that journey take?
To Rossi?
Yeah.
Well, it'd take about 5 hours, five and a half hours, according to the weather, up to Rossi. It's in the Selwyn, the Clyde, the outer Clyde, you see, the Selwyn Clyde. And it's a beautiful place, so it's quite a big harbour, deep water. But you couldn't remain alongside. They landed your passengers, you'd go to anchor, because there's other ships taking the place with the ones in their berths, you see.
Right, so quite a busy place to go to.
Quite busy. Yeah. Those days, anyhow, I don't know what it's like today, of course.
It's all different. So the first real sort of passenger started coming over for Easter holidays, I presume.
Yes, Easter, yes. Then Easter, you'd have a lull. You used to send two ships in at Douglas Breakwater, cleaning up and painting up, brighten them up. What hadn't been done in Barrow or Birkenhead when we left, would be finished there in that period,
right.
after Easter.
Right. And then when would the big rush start?
Oh, the rush was up then, before TT, that was the rush TT.
So it was then as well as it is today?
TT. I remember my last TT on this Ben McCree there. She was a magnificent ship then. Now, we were to do 16 trips non-stop with the Manx Maid. And the Manx Maid was still, she's brand new. She's out on trials, you see. But unfortunately, she broke down or something went wrong. She went back into dock and we had to do the 16 trips on our own. We're going to go backwards
and forwards.
It was a tough time. The weather wasn't too bad, but the visibility wasn't too good. Because Muggins then was up on the bridge more so. And the poor old chief engineer, a good chap he was. We had very good engineers in our ships, excellent engineers. But this for Mr. Curfee, he was a wonderful chap, but he'd a bad hip. Well, I pitied that man up and down them stairs. He had a tough time. But But they are all very wonderful engineers altogether.
Right, so there were engineers on board the whole time you were sailing to make sure that everything went smoothly.
They were good chaps. I remember one time this chap Curfew, we were on the winter service, this was, I was sent round to Peel, the southeast gales, you see. I was round the Peel, going in between the chicken's lighthouse and the end of the calf there. It was pretty nasty. And the chief engineer came up, Mr. Curfew. Well, Captain, he said, it's going to be a busy time going into Peel today. It's going to be pretty dicky and the sleet, snow, you see. I said, yes, what would he be? I had a strange second mate. Now, the second mate is very important in and out of port. He does the steering. He was the captain of the air course doing maneuver and whatnot. He got very accurate, the second mate. That's his more, one of his most particular jobs. And me at Bosun's now, the old lady I met at Bosun's. But the idea, I think the steam packet idea was that you're training them what was going on. You'd see what was going on. It was a good idea, really, see. But when you got some strange second officers there, they couldn't understand it, you see. Well, this time I had a strange second mate. He'd never seen Peel. And was sleeping at one point. Anyhow, to cut a long story short, you're twin screw engines, you see. Well, going into Peel, especially the water, and blowing hard down on the breakwater, your main sacrifice was to come further stern on the inside engine, the starboard engine. Because if she's blowing down, it would throw her stern off, you see. It's a simple manoeuvre, but it's a very important. So I said to our chief, I said, who's on the starboard engine going in, chief? He said, the third engineer. But never mind, Captain, I'll go down. And you know, rather funny when you look back, you know. I followed her on starboard and she nearly shot her in the harbour. Those little incidents, you know. There's always a smile when everything may seem so bad and everything is against you, but there's always a sense of humour comes from you, if you can find it.
So you used to go into Peel quite often, did you?
Oh yes, any southeast winds. As I can't understand this recent southeast winds I've had here, how they went back to Liverpool or whatnot.
Yeah.
Because even they were around to Peel to land the passengers, even they couldn't land the cars. But that's not to do with me. I shouldn't comment on it, I suppose. Because I've got a nephew of mine, he's the deputy chief. What to do? There's all sorts of news.
Marine superintendent.
He's the second command. But they're two good chaps, Mr. the present Marine superintendent, Mr. Corran. He's a very nice chap, Peter Corran. Nice chap he is, too. And so is Brian Kinsley. Not Brian, I forget his name. I shouldn't, because he'd be old nephew. they're two good lads, very good lads.
Yeah.
Different than some of the superintendents used to have, do you mean?
So you had the same kind of superintendents in your day as
yes,
well?
Yes.
What's their job?
Kinley's.
What's their responsibility? What do they...
What, superintendent?
Yeah.
I'll give you an idea in that book, I'll tell you there. But they're responsible for the fitting out of the vessels. And master's responsible for his own ship, of course. He's responsible. Everything that happens aboard the ship, he's responsible for.
Right.
But he can come aboard and try to countermand an order, you see. I've seen some trouble with that. But anyhow, that's his main job. And when the ship's going for survey, he goes along with the surveyors, you see. See, she'd probably surveyed along with the chief officer. Because the captain goes, when she's in for survey, he goes ashore. But the chief officer's in charge, and the ship's surveyors, board of trade, they come aboard very often with the superintendent. It's all taken down what they're doing, you see, the whole ship. It all depends what survey she's on. There's an annual survey, and a four-yearly survey. The four-yearly is quite the big survey. Every part of the vessel surveyed.
So it's all, like a sort of service,
a car survey. But now I think they've broke it up into 2 years and 4 years. The cost is terrific.
Is it like a safety check as well?
Absolutely. Everything is thoroughly overhauled.
Right.
Well, even to a lock on the door. Right. Everything.
So what was safety?
They're very safe.
What was safety like in your day? You mentioned lifeboats before.
Yes. Yeah.
What was the drills and
well, we never drilled quite the drills, but you see, my day, they only had two lifeboats motorized, right. And they're petrol engines, and you can bet your life they wouldn't go off first time you had a boat drill. We'd have the boat drill nearly over, and the engineers out there still winding the petrol engine up, you see. So it made it very awkward for our drills, but now that they got diesel engines, and I think in every boat, we had just the two, the port and starboard leading boats, they had these petrol engines. They were a damn curse, believe you me.
Were there life jackets for all
the... Oh, yes, there was life jackets, isn't it?
There were.
They're equipped with life, and you must have a life jacket on. Sailors and everybody must have a life jacket on, you see. And it's quite interesting. Now, for instance, now, lifeboat drill, one of my last trips in the Ben McCree, there's a person off the side, a passenger.
Really?
Yeah. Anyway, we searched for him for an hour, and there's a French trawler come up and gave us a hand, but we didn't buy him. It was a northwesterly gale, with a gale all the way from Liverpool. And the only time I left the bridge for a minute, it happened. But when I come back, we turned round to go back searching. And all the crackers aboard this day too. And the crew were in that boat, ready for lowering in 4 minutes. 4 minutes.
Was this in the Irish Sea?
With their life jackets.
Yeah.
Yes. That's my last trip, one of my last, I remember 1930, late 1930s, 19th. January 1938, 1930. I just forget offhand. It was one of my last trips anyhow.
So did passengers go overboard frequently? Or?
Well, what happened in this case, you see, no one actually seen him go over, and the two passengers happened to look over the side, being seasick, and seen this thing going past them, you see. And he committed suicide. And what he'd done, it was obvious that he'd someone that knew something about ships, because he took all his clothes off neatly on the deck, and he opened the top half of the cargo door. See, but it was impossible for anybody to see him. And out he goes. His brother crossed over the next day. He expected that he was going to commit suicide.
Right.
That's the only incident I really entered that head like that.
It's pretty hard to fall off unless you're attempting to.
I remember one time they were coming down, we come from Ostend, this in the wall, and one of the soldiers jumped over the side. And this greatcoat kept him up until our lifeboat got right up to him, and then he disappeared. The late Mr. Frank Cannell, he was the second mate at that time. His second mate goes away in the lifeboat, and he said, he's in charge of the lifeboat when he tried to do anything happens like that.
Right. It's like nowadays when you go on the King Ory, they tell you all about the muster stations and where you have to assemble to collect your life jacket
and things like that.
Was there that similar kind of thing?
Oh yes, they had drills like that.
And how were the passengers told? How was it relayed to the passengers?
Well, they accepted it.
It's
a novelty to them, you see, it does some of them.
Was it over a loudspeaker system, the same way that it is?
Yes, it was a loudspeaker system.
Right.
It was a novelty to them. You take pictures of themselves and life belts and things like that.
Right.
In fact, sometimes it'd be a job to get their life belts off them. Rather enjoyed it.
I was asking you about the crews before and how many people would serve on the vessels. Where did they all come from? Were they from the island or from Liverpool? Or?
Well, they come from all over England. England and Scotland. You see, we used to have different wakes, they call them those days. The Yorkshire wakes, the Bradford wakes, and all those
wicks.
Different wakes. It's like a section of that country, mills and everything were shut down. That be their way, and you knew exactly where they come from and when they were coming. Oh, year ahead. And by Jove, they were wonderful people, the Yorkshire people and all those people that come down those wakes, and be the Scottish wakes too. But they were really wonderful people. They made the island. There was people coming on the wakes. They never hear them growling or anything like that. Never at all. They accepted everything as it was, and they really enjoyed themselves. All young couples, of course. Because they come from the mills.
That was for the holidays, wasn't it?
Yes, for the holidays.
Right. But the crews, the people actually worked on the boats, they came from
Mostly from the Manx, from the Isle of Man.
From the Isle of Wight itself?
A lot of student staff came from Liverpool, around about there. Especially those for summer, employed for summer months only.
Right.
You see? They came from about Liverpool, Cheshire, around there. But the majority of seamen in particular, they were mostly Manx chaps. There's quite a lot of the officers now in English, the English officers came to England.
Okay. So you didn't really, did you spend a lot of time, would you have been at sea for a long time, or you'd come home quite regularly, would you, because you were fairly short?
Well, in the summertime, especially if you're on the, unfortunately, be on the Fleetwood run, you're a later man, you weren't getting home at all.
Right.
You have any weekend in Fleetwood, you see. And I used to make arrangements with one of the clerks in the office. They're all good chaps, splendid fellow. He would live in Castle, he'd take money home with him because you're paid weekly then, you see. Different world is today. And even if you went on the Fleetwood run and you were in Douglas probably every day, there's still times you could scarcely get home.
Right.
Because you're either dressing your ship or getting ready to take cargo or getting passengers off, you see. Unless you're actually tied up for the night, then you have to be back either that night, mostly that night, or the next morning. It was mostly that night because the only person who was allowed to stay home was the man that watched night watch from the night before, at Liverpool anywhere he was, you see. He got a night off, a day and a night off.
Right. So where did you stay when you were in Fleetwood? Did you stay on the boat?
Oh, I stayed on the ship. You had your own accommodation, quite good accommodation. Right. Plenty of food, you know, well. Catered for.
Right.
Of course, at the night time, you'll always be the chief officer, and the second officer always going ashore for a little bit of liquid refreshment, of course.
Well.
It had a hard day, you see.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. In terms of, we've talked about rough weather before. I mean, can you remember any particularly rough journeys there? You might have been a little bit scared, or
well, yes, I've had some really rough days. I've been coming out from Fleetwood one day, and we were going a little bit faster than we should have been. We hit the bank here. Come on, Rebel. Here, come on.
Get down.
Come on. Get down. Sit. Come on. And if we hit one godly wave coming like a mountain. And she took about 14 feet of rail off the port side of the ship. And incidents like that happen, you see. But we've never really been in any danger with our ships.
No.
As long as you treated them bad, eased them down, that was the principal thing, easing them down from about 22 knots down to about 18. That was a happy, just a nice speed. Oh, it was really, really, really gale for us, full gale. You went down to about as much as 14 knots.
So it's about the speed of...
Yes, you judged yourself the weather conditions, the size of the sea, and the easter up, and where you were. If you're getting near any shallow water, running down a Liverpool bar, you see, at low water, you get some nasty seas running down there. Really bad seas.
So shallow water could be quite dodgy then.
And they start swooning about like this. She gets a ship smell, as we call smelling the ground, but when she gets in shallow water, and there's not so much buoyancy underneath, you see. You'll feel them shudder, and it's, instead of the steam falling off them, it keeps it coming over, tumbling over. I've seen in the coaster many of them having some queer dues with that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Being caught on the Liverpool Bar, of course, well, therefore the coasters, where they can be a really serious business.
So really, it's about the piloting of the ships into the harbour. That's one of the sort of most complicated parts of
yes,
the journey.
Yes, it is complicated.
What does it entail?
Strong tides, you see, but fog is the worst thing, of course.
Fog.
Right, fog. But now we got radar, and radar came in, but when I first in the company in 1936, later on after the war, we didn't have radar.
So
what
did you do?
We had to rely on fog and our own initiative. We all knew the river pretty well, and the second mate of the master in particular, he had a Liverpool license, so I had the chief officer very often, you see.
What does that mean, Liverpool?
Liverpool license for Liverpool, the port of Liverpool.
So he could sail into the port of Liverpool?
Yes, yes. In fact, you had to have the license for Liverpool, Heysham, Fleetwood, and a Drossen, you see. You had to have, and then now also you have to the Dublin license, you see. And it's quite an examination, because the area covers from east of Locks, as the entrance to Manchester Ship Canal, down at the west side of the river, the Mersey, past Birkenhead, Sunlight, all those little places down past Birkenhead Locks, including the docks in there and dock entrances, right down then to New Brighton, and then out to the main channel, Queen's Channel, or the Rock Channel, but the Rock Channel is no longer there now. Out to the Queen's Channel, Crosby Channel, Forby Channel, down to Point Linus and onto the Skerries. That's the south coast of Wales, northwest tip of Wales, you see, to Point Linus. From there across to the Chicken Rock Lighthouse in the Isle of Man. Then up the east coast of the Isle of Man, included Port St Mary, Derby Haven, Douglas, and Ramsey, and so forth. From there across to the Point of Ayr to St Bee's Head in Cumberland. St Bee's Head in Cumberland down in the west coast, down past the Selkirk, down past Barrow, and Fleetwood, the entrance to Preston, which is Preston is closed now, but, and then and Fleetwood, and then up the channel then in Liverpool, from the bar up to the Queen's Channel, the Crosby Channel, Formby Channel, Queen's Channel, up then on the line of docks, there's 5 miles of line of docks, up past Deagle Oil Jetty and up to Garston, and up to West Bank Dock, because you never go up there, of course, but up to Garston. From Garston, cross the banks to Eastern River, at the entrance to Manchester Ship Canal, and that's the area. And in that you must know every light, every depth, the contours, the regulations and bylaws, the whole lot, the depth of the water at every buoy, and the depth on the sill of each dock entrance, and how to go in each dock, how to take the various times of tide. There's quite a lot attached to it, believe you me.
Absolutely.
It is. There's all the contour out on the open sea too. You've got the buoys and lighthouses out in the whole of the Irish Sea, yeah. In that area.
So what's Douglas Harbour like to negotiate?
Well, it's quite good, Douglas Harbour, except with inshore wind. Right. It can be a very tricky place then, of course. See, when I was sailing, we had no breakwater. You see, I'm glad you asked this question. We had no breakwater whatsoever.